Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In this episode, we'll meet a few incredible dogs who help people to heal, like Paca, who helps children overcome emotional trauma and even helps encourage them to read.
We have children who talk to her. We have told them that they can tell Paca anything. We've got one little boy that'll lift her ear up like a flap, and he'll just whisper and talk to her. It is a completely objective, non-judgmental, listening ear.
And we'll travel to a special cemetery reserved only for coonhound dogs.
Ever since I was a little boy, all my ancestors was hunters. We've hunted pretty much all our life, which Daddy said he kept us in the woods to keep us out of trouble.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This show is dedicated to those furry friends who often greet us when we get home from a long trip. They enjoy a belly rub and at times chew on our brand new computer cable or leave a little unwelcome present on the carpet. And of course, most of us are familiar with the concept of seeing eye dogs, but service dogs do plenty of other jobs to help people. In this next story, Roxy Todd introduces us to a service dog who helps children overcome emotional trauma and even helps encourage them to read.
What kind of dog is Paca?
Trained dog.
Paca is an English Black Labrador service dog who works with elementary school students at the Mary C. Snow Elementary School on Charleston's west side. One of Paca's roles is to help children who are emotionally in need of some extra love. Assistant Principal Jordan McBride.
Our population of students are 84% free and reduced lunch, so we have the highest poverty rate in Kanawha County.
McBride explains that Paca the dog is actually used in this school to help children who are going through some very stressful situations at home.
Our students experience a lot of trauma. Paca kind of comes in with that, that she is used as our therapy dog for students that are in need.
Watch this.
Paca was trained by prison inmates at a state prison in Kansas. After her training there, Paca came to West Virginia in 2011 to work at the Mary C. Snow School when it first opened. The money to pay for Paca's training was raised by the school's librarian, Debbie Canada. Canada also traveled to Kansas to adopt Paca and to receive her own handler training. As I walk through the library door, I find Paca stretched out on a brightly colored rug. She's relaxed but watchful.
When we come through the door in the morning, her tail is wagging, her eyes are bright. She's the most excited to be here of anybody on the staff.
Paca usually senses whenever a child has been going through a difficult time and is in need of some special attention.
We have children who talk to her. We have told them that they can tell Paca anything, and they'll get down and sit beside her and just whisper, talk into her ear. We've got one little boy that'll lift her ear up like a flap, and he'll just whisper and talk to her. It is a completely objective, non-judgmental, listening ear where he can say anything he needs to say. And nobody's going to look down on him for what he just whispered to that dog, And we don't know what he says to her, and it doesn't matter. He feels like he's been listened to.
Miss Canada says that little bit of pocket love often goes a long way to calm a child down.
I saw her step between two children who were angry with each other, and she's basically nosed in between them, wiggled her body in between them, and the act of her wiggling her body between them kind of made them giggle, because she looked funny trying to get between them. And it de-escalated the situation instantly. They both just started petting her and laughing about the fact she looked so silly trying to get between them.
Paca spends most of her working day in the library, but she also visits other classrooms for story time. Cindy Schumann teaches third grade, and Paca is a regular reading companion for this classroom. Today, the children are taking turns reading to Paca, who occasionally lays her head in their lap or puts her paw on their leg.
Bear opened one eye and groaned. We can be business partners, Harris said.
Paca also works one-on-one with students who are struggling with reading. Children are invited to come to the library to visit Paca, to read to her, to talk to her, to pet her.
It's a done deal.
She always answers it with a kiss, you know, a big, wet, sloppy kiss, and they think that's just the best thing ever.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston. As Roxy mentioned, Paca the dog was trained by prison inmates in Kansas. But since 2007, prisons in West Virginia have launched a similar dog training program. In this next part of the story, Roxy travels to a prison in Pleasance County, West Virginia, to meet some of the inmate dog trainers there. The prison yard is surrounded by razor wire fencing. About 50 men are outside wearing khaki jumpsuits and orange jackets. In many ways, this could be any other medium security prison, except that there are about 15 golden retrievers being led around on leashes in the sunlight. St. Mary's is one of five state prisons in West Virginia that trains service dogs as part of a program called Paws for People. The program started in 2007 at the Hazleton Federal Prison in Preston County, and a couple of years ago it moved to the state prisons. Stefan is an inmate here, and for the last 10 months, he's been working to train an English cream Labrador retriever named Leo.
Since I have had Leo, he has taught me things such as a lot of things about myself, such as myself having anger problems, tolerance problems, because when you're dealing with dogs, you have to have tolerance and be able to control your anger. And if you have them problems and you don't really recognize it, they'll bring it out of you. And either you're going to get it together or you're just not going to have them anymore.
Patrick Morandi is the warden here.
The dog stays with these guys 24 hours a day. These dogs, there's a primary handler and there's a secondary handler. And they're paired up. But when they get paired up, their whole job is to watch these dogs 24 hours a day. They bathe them. They care for them. They feed them. They train them, which training is any time that they're with them.
But after months of training, today is what's known as the bump, where the dogs will meet their prospective new clients. For the inmates, this means their dog is about to leave the prison to go finish their service dog training and live with their new client.
There's a lot of tears. The toughest guy in here cries whenever his dog leaves.
Amanda Anderson is the program manager at the St. Mary's Correctional Center for the Paws for People unit.
I couldn't imagine what they go through. I struggle sometimes, you know, because you do get attached. So, and with them, I mean, they're putting everything they have into that dog. But they know it's for a good cause, but it's still hard.
Oh, yeah. To see the dogs leave, it's always tough seeing them leave because they grew up with you. You know, I mean, you played a part in getting them to where they need to be to go to somebody. And it's horrible seeing them leave. But you know it's for a good cause. That's what makes it a lot easier to look at. It's for a good cause. And you know you played a part in making somebody else's life better. That's what makes the feeling worth it. It's like it's a relief. Because I'm one that's always, my whole life, have been in trouble. So to finally give back, it's giving back. Not because somebody told me to, because I wanted to. And that's why it's a relief to see that you're actually doing something positive without being told you have to do it. It feels good to take a step and do something on your own that's actually good and be proud of it.
Cece Miller is the Deputy Operations Officer for the Paws for People Foundation. She says the inmate trainers go through a kind of emotional transformation as they realize the impact of their work.
But that's the thing with them is they're so humble, and this program has given them something that no other program has given them, and that's a piece of themselves back that they lost.
It would be nice to show that this program is helping prisoners rehabilitate back into society. But the program is so new that information isn't available yet. Still, Warden Morandi says he has seen a big difference in the inmate trainers.
I'm sure, based on what I've seen statistically, the guys in that program are much more well-behaved than guys in our general population area that we have out here.
W-A-V, good girl. D-O-W-N.
The inmates train the dogs 100 commands. The dogs learn how to serve disabled clients by doing things like opening a fridge.
That's it. That's it. Close it. Good girl. Good girl. That's it. Good girl. W-A-V-E. R-O-L-L. That's it.
The dogs are also trained to help veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder.
I'm going to walk toward Cole's trainer, and Cole will alert him by nudging his leg whenever I get within so many feet. And that's a command that we teach for veterans with post-traumatic stress. It assists them in knowing that there's someone close to them so they're not startled.
The Bump is a two-day event that takes place inside the prison's gymnasium. In front of a crowd of people, the dogs are introduced to their new clients one at a time.
I was apprehensive on having a dog, how a dog chooses its client, until I went and saw one. And, you know, it is a very emotional time. It's a very trying time for some of the clients to come into a facility. You know, they have anxiety issues anyway coming in here, but they come in and sit and they have a dog. And you'll actually see a dog who may not pay any attention to the client when he walks up to him. And in itself, that's sad. But then you'll see another dog walk through that just wants all the attention from that individual. That dog may have passed on three other person, but the one person, it has this aura effect or whatever. So it's really there. And until you really see the Bump process or see what they're doing, I was skeptical till I saw the big picture.
Often, the dog will bump up against someone and nestle against their body when they feel a strong bond with that person.
The Bump reminds me of an extent of that the dog senses things in them rather to the nature of whether they want to be there or not. Not so much as they're angry, but so much as what they're going through. They sense that. And if they can't deal with it, they don't want nothing to do with them. And that's beautiful.
I asked Stefan, what will it be like for him when Leo chooses his new client and they have to part ways?
What will help me get over that? I know I'm going to get another dog. But he's still not this dog, but I know I'm going to get another dog. And what's going to help me get over it is knowing that he's going somewhere that he's needed. He's not needed here. I might say I need him, but there's another one coming behind him. He's going where he's needed, where he can do some good for somebody, where he can make somebody else's life better. And he will. He'll make somebody else's life better. Today is Leo's birthday. He is a year old today. And I know I'm not going to have him too much longer, but while he was here, he made me happy.
The second day of the Bump, Leo the dog did find his match. Leo will be working as a medical alert service dog for a civilian client in Georgia who has post-traumatic stress disorder. Meanwhile, Stefan has a new puppy named Nolan that he's training as his next service dog. Later in our show, we'll hear the last part of this story when we meet one of the golden retrievers that was trained in a West Virginia prison. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. When we come back, we're going to go dog mushing in snowy Pennsylvania.
Finding on the corner with a low-down blues, a great big hole in the bottom of my shoes. Honey, let me be your solid dog. Let me be your solid dog, or I won't be your man at all. Honey, let me be your solid dog.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Oh, there's your buddies, there's your buddies.
Racing across a frozen landscape behind a team of dogs. It's not just for Alaskans. Dog sledding is popular in our neck of the woods, too. Back this winter, when snow still covered our mountains, the Allegheny Front's Kara Hulsoppel visited some enthusiasts practicing the sport at Laurel Mountain State Park in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania.
Stay. Oh, you got Matt Phillips and Sarah White are unloading precious cargo, their dogs, from the back seat of a black hatchback.
This is Sitka. He's a long-haired woolly husky. which is a purebred Siberian husky, but it's a different genetic trait than people are used to with the longer fur.
And they have another dog, Koske. He's a German Shepherd Husky mix with short brown fur and pointy black ears.
So why did you decide to become a musher, a dog sledder?
Koske showed up at my friend's doorstep Easter 2 years ago. So I brought him home, and he was just full of energy, and I would run him with my bike and stuff like that. But over the winter, I was like, he's half husky. I should give this a shot. See if he knows how to do the dog sledding thing.
So we found this group, West Penn Mushers, online.
Oh, there's your buddies. There's your buddies.
As soon as they know they're going mushing, they start howling and howling, and they love it.
That's Karen Bodai. She's also pretty new to the group. Phillips is borrowing her blue-eyed therapy dog, Apache. That way Phillips can take me out on the sled.
This is a four-dog line, so we're going to just hook two of them together so we can use it as a three-dog line for us today. It's just a long leash, and then the sled has bungees underneath of it where it's hooked on, so that it absorbs some of the shock from the dogs going forward and backwards a bunch. All right, you want to go start hooking them up? Apache, are you ready to go? We're going to put Koske in the lead. All right, ready? Ready? Hike, 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 hike. Hike, hike, hike. Good dogs, good dogs. Hike, hike. Once they get the idea, once they see other dogs doing it, they pick it up in a hurry.
We're traveling about 10 miles an hour down a completely snow-covered road. But Phillip says you don't need more than a couple of inches. It's flying up under the dog's feet. Phillips calls this a slow trot.
Keep it up. Keep it up. Hike, hike, hike. Come on. Hike means let's go. A lot of people think it's mush. I think some movies and cartoons and stuff like that kind of gave the misinformation there. Mush is just the sport name. Good dogs. All right, Koske, back haw. Koske, come here. Back haw.
Back haw. Koske. That means turn around to the left. It almost works. Koske looks like he'd rather run off and play in the woods to either side of us.
As well as he follows the directions for the most part, he also has an attitude. Come on, Koske, hike! Good dog, take us home.
The dogs come in for a landing in the parking lot and lap up some much-deserved water after they're unhooked from the sled. Between runs is a good time for the mushers to trade tips and learn from one another. Beth Talentire has been mushing for 25 years. Her big white Samoyeds are show dogs, and they wear pink booties to protect their paws.
Teach woe first, because I lost my team one time.
You lost what?
My team. They want to run, man.
It's addicting.
It is addicting. I'm really happy when somebody new comes up.
The Facebook group's grown a lot recently. It's up to over 200 people. And Phillips is hoping to grow his pack, too. He says he doesn't have anything against cats, but he's a dog person. And for him, the appeal of the sport is simple.
It's nice to just be out here, be in the nature, being with the dogs, finding the elements for what they are.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsoppel.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry, Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and take it with you wherever you go. Today we've been featuring stories about dogs, service dogs, and athletic dogs so far. But here in Appalachia, dogs are often known as our companions for bear and coon hunting. Coon hunting was a regular topic of conversation when my great-uncle Roger came to town. He drove all the way from Michigan to join up with my other uncles to go coon hunting. For the Traveling 219 Project, Caitlin Witt brings us this glimpse of bear hunting in the mountains of Pocahontas County, West Virginia. The Walker family of Pocahontas County is synonymous with bear hunting across the state of West Virginia. Eugene Walker, the middle of 11 children, and his brothers are natural-born hunters. Eugene grew up hunting in the days of walkie-talkies and carbide lamps, learning to track from bear hunting legends, and has since become a bit of a legend himself. Bear hunting is a hobby for many, but for Eugene, it is a way of life.
I started coon hunting with Dad when I was about 5 years old, which would have been 1950, I guess. And I can recall many a night stalking along behind him and go to sleep walking. And when he'd stop to listen for the dog or to take a rest or whatever, I'd walk right into him, you know, and wake myself up. And he'd always turn around and say, "You wake, boy?" I can remember many times doing that. Just so tired, and it was cold, and fall, winter nights, you know, but I wouldn't trade it for nothing. I started bear hunting back when I was about 8 years old. I'd go with the old guys around the area that went. K.K. Weimer, Homer Kellison, Arthur Larbagas, Lee Dean. Sort of as a gopher, you just went along. You didn't have a weapon or anything. You just led dogs, pulled a bear. You did the grunt work. They'd decide where he went, and they'd just pull up on the side of the mountain and get you out four, five, six dogs with whole dog chains to lead them with, no lead straps like we got today, and take through the mountain and hope you found one. These young hunters today, if they had to hunt like we hunted back then, there'd only be a handful of bear hunters left. Yeah, it's a world of difference.
There is more to hunting bear than just the kill. To Eugene, it's really about the chase, the dogs, the hunters, and the stories they come together to tell.
I don't do it to kill. I do it to hear the hounds run and the chase and see your dogs perform well. That does me more good than pulling the trigger, because once you kill one, you don't run that one no more. You know, I used to hunt a lot with Glenn Cook, Redbeard we called him. But he was one of those colorful characters that I dearly loved and loved to hunt with. And back when I had the old hacksaw and Charlie Brown dogs, we started loose on a bear on the side of Brary. And Redbeard sort of talked through his nose, and he said, "Coon Hunter, I'm going to follow them dogs, and I'll get that bear." He took off, and we didn't know where he went or which direction he went. So I spent most of the day looking for him and trying to find him and my dogs. And when I finally found him, I went around and went up in Robin's Fork and was up in the Fitzwater country. And I ran into him coming down the road, pulling that bear and leading the dog. And he got down there and he said, "Coon Hunter, I'll never kill another mare as long as I live." Said, "That just looked like a man falling out of that tree." And I guess he never did kill another bear after that. We got a younger generation up now. I'm the old guy now. I'm the K.K. Weimer or the Arthur Larbagas or whomever it might be now. Hopefully I helped some of them, taught them a few things. I had a young kid tell me this year, he said, "Every time I go with you, I learn something."
We'll hear the next part of this story in the second half of our show when hunter James McComb tells us about a frightening encounter he had with a bear that weighed over 400 pounds. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. So where do you think you might find a very special final resting place reserved for hunting dogs? It's a place in southern Appalachia that's somewhat famous for its Coonhound Dog Cemetery. Where is it? We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. Hunters often have a special connection to their coon dogs. After all, it's the dog that has to perform well to make a successful coon hunt. So it's no surprise that some coon dogs with a superior hunting record are laid to rest at the Coon Dog Cemetery in Cherokee, Alabama. 2 years ago, folks in Cherokee celebrated the 75th anniversary of the Coonhound Cemetery. But how did the idea for the cemetery first come about, and what famous coonhound dogs are buried here? NPR's Debbie Elliott visited the cemetery where only the finest of coon dogs are remembered.
You think you're surely lost winding down the lush country roads outside of Cherokee, Alabama, hardly passing another car. and then a hand-painted sign with a red arrow points to the Coon Dog Cemetery. Local hunter Frankie Hatton is waiting with his blue tick hound, Cletus.
I've had the same bloodline pretty much for ever since I was a little boy. See, all my ancestors was hunters. We've hunted pretty much all our life, which Daddy said he kept us in the woods to keep us out of trouble.
Raccoon hunting is a night sport. The dogs are put out near a creek bed or corn patch at dusk, and the hunters wait and listen.
When he settles down and goes to chopping steady, that's when you know he's tree.
Meaning he's chased a raccoon up a tree and is barking up after it. Not distracted by a squirrel or armadillo, but zeroed in on a coon. It's a skill that takes years of training and a deep relationship between hunter and coon dog. The kind of relationship that would make you want to bury your companion in a special spot.
Key Underwood started this place when he buried old Troop. And there's old Troop right there.
Troop is legendary in these parts, known to track a coon from cold tracks. He was trained by a whiskey maker in these hills, known to hide the occasional still. Underwood marked his grave with an old chimney stone chiseled with a hammer and screwdriver.
You see, he's been buried September the 4th, 1937. And this was Key Underwood's favorite spot to hunt. So when Troop passed away, he brought him here and buried him.
That was 75 years ago. Now, there are more than 300 dogs buried with Troop, including Lulabelle, Preacher, Squeak, Bear, and Dr. Doom. All certified breeds, Hatton says, who have met high standards.
You have to have three references that have to contact us and have actually witnessed the dog tree a coon by himself.
Not with another dog.
Not with another dog, all by himself, where he can prove that he done it on his own and he didn't have any help.
The graves are lined up on the crest of a shady hill. The newer ones marked with traditional headstones, the older ones carved from wood or handmade from whatever materials were on hand. Sticks tied together at a cross with a dog collar, a broiler plate from an old stove. Under a rustic picnic pavilion, a binder serves as guest book, logging the thousands of visitors a year who stop at the Coon Dog Cemetery. Among them are Carol and Bob Pearson of Greenville, Kentucky.
We'd never seen anything like this. Never.
It's unusual. And we're rural people anyway, and I used to coon hunt, so it means a lot to me.
The peaceful hillside is also a gathering spot for local hunters. Frankie Hatton says he's been coming here since he was a toddler, listening to the old-timers tell their stories.
And the first thing they'll start out with, you remember that night? And then they'll start in. Especially if it's the night they beat you, outdone you. They'll remind you of it.
Hatton has two champion dogs buried here, Blue Flash and Flash Jr., grandfather and great-grandfather to his current hound, Cletus.
Will he be buried here?
It all depends on how good he does.
And what kind of stories Frankie Hatton can tell of his nights in the North Alabama woods coon hunting with Cletus. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
That story first aired on NPR's Morning Edition in 2012. Now, in this second installment of Bear Tales, James McComb gives us a glimpse into a life lived off the land and spins the story of a hunt that was almost his last. Again, here's Caitlin Witt of Traveling 219.
The McComb family has been in Pocahontas County, West Virginia for generations, farming for money and hunting for food. James McComb, Jim to his neighbors, was raised on the land, learning to hunt and trap when he was still a child.
They even carried me. I can remember scared when they just set you down and go on, so you stay there till we get back. Oh, scared to death. When they got tired, they just set you down there and tell you they'd be back to get you. Believe it or not, we used a lantern. One of them old kerosene lanterns, all we had for a light.
Under the wing of Argyll Arbogast, one of the most famous hunters in Pocahontas, Jim learned to hunt bear as a teenager, chasing after sheep-killing bear that threatened the livelihood of farmers across the county in the days when the chase was about more than sport.
About 140-some years with Argel. Well, we rode horses together all the time, too. We used to ride a lot and got started hunting with him. We hunted a lot of sheep killers that killed sheep. We was on a lot of them. About any person my age that bear hunted, when they was young, they started out with Argel Arbogast. Back when I growed up, the bear hunter was well thought of. Everybody had a lot of respect for him. Your dog come into somebody's house, they would tie the dog up and feed it, write you a letter. If he didn't have a phone, they'd send you a letter. They'd say, come and get him whenever the first chance he's out that way, or he wasn't bothering nothing. But we had respect for the farmers and everybody else, too. We didn't go where we wasn't supposed to, and we never tore nothing up. And I mean, you know, that makes a lot of difference. Anybody can go bear hunting today if you've got the stuff to do it with. And you don't have to walk. I mean, well, you got to walk. I don't care where you're at, but you don't have to walk very far. Because you can take that new tracking outfit and you can know where your dog's at all times. And it even shows them when they tree. And it don't lie very often, I'm telling you, it don't. It used to be you depend on your ears and you walk. I mean, that's the way you went.
Jim's legacy as a hunter is made up of stories about heroic dogs, crafty hunters, and bear that just wouldn't give up the fight.
5 or 6 years ago, I just almost got bit bad. It wasn't no little bear. It weighed 408 pounds. I drove by and I looked in the mirror of the truck, and there was all the dogs in the road. And I got out of the truck, and when I got out of the truck and looked up, there he stood up, sitting up in that tree. I walked up there and shot one time, and it come out of the tree, fell in the side ditch, dead, was supposed to be. I was standing there looking at it, and it jumped up on all four and made a lunge at me. And I run backwards, as fast as I could run. I mean, from here to, well, I don't know how far I went. Dogs hanging right on the back of it. He didn't pay attention to dogs. And that's when I decided I was going to have to do something. And I turned and run to the truck as fast as I could run. And it dawned on me I just had one shell in the gun. And I rested in my pocket and put two shells in it. And when I turned around to shoot it, the gun was in the middle of its back. It was reaching up here to get me by the stomach. And I just stuck the gun right between his ears and pulled the trigger. And that's as close as I ever come. I couldn't lead a bunch of dogs a day if I had to. Well, it was nothing to see me lead 8 or 10 dogs one time. I mean, was nothing to it. Well, now I'm lucky to lead one, much less 5 or 6. Makes you mad. But you can't let things up get you down. I go till I can't go and I stop.
That was Caitlin Witt for the Traveling 219 Project, talking with bear hunter James McComb. Photos from the McComb's hunt are on our website, wvpublic.org.
Pulled the trigger and the gun said go, the shot fell over in Mexico. And let me be your soldado. Let me be your soldado.
Earlier in this show, we heard about service dogs who are being trained by prison inmates through a program called Paws for People. For the final part of this story, our producer Roxy Todd introduces us to a service dog named Mason, who is trained in a West Virginia state prison. Mason is a golden retriever who lives in Fairmont. He's a service dog who helps 11-year-old Josh Greger.
He's playful. He likes anybody. He really likes kids. He alerts to the fire alarm when I can't hear it.
Josh has a hearing disability and a few other medical issues. Mason is trained to alert Josh or his parents if any of his equipment, like his feeding tube, needs attention. Josh's mother, Tracy, says that when they first met Mason, it was clear right off the bat that the dog and the boy had a connection.
It was really just a bond at first sight. Mason took right to Josh, and he went and stayed with him all day long.
And Tracy says that the dog helps her cope with emotional stress, too.
The empathy is really unbelievable as it develops. It gets stronger each day. Mason has developed that really with most of our family also. Having a child with special needs is a very stressful thing, and he picks up on that too. And so a lot of times he'll come and he'll stick his head in my lap just to, you know, to calm my nerves and stuff, and I'll quit thinking about what I'm thinking about and pet him and play with him and stuff. Just about a
year and a half. Tracy says Mason also relieves stress by doing what most dogs do.
He's funny. He's goofy. He still acts like a dog sometimes.
Mason was trained by two female inmates at the Lakin State Prison in West Virginia. When they first brought Mason home, Tracy asked if their family could visit the prison to meet the trainers.
So we were able to go back and thank the inmates for the work that they spent, because truly the program could not be what it is if the inmates don't do what they do and do it so well.
Five West Virginia state prisons train service dogs as part of a partnership with a nonprofit called Paws for People. According to Paws for People, with the help of service dogs like Mason, adults and children like Josh with special needs are able to increase their independence by 80%. That also means less work for caretakers and family members. Cece Miller helps run Paws for People.
So we believe in the canine bond. We believe that you can pour your heart and your soul into this dog, and he's not going to judge you. He's going to be right there for you. He's still going to look at you and be like, you are the best person in the world, no matter what you have done in your life.
Archaeologists believe that our canine bond goes back for at least 15,000 years. Dogs were the very first animals that we humans domesticated. So maybe it's not really that surprising that dogs have the ability to communicate with us on such an emotional level. And a big part of the job description of a service dog is simply to comfort clients, sticking by them even during the toughest of times. Recently, Josh had to go to a children's hospital for some medical treatment. Mason was there with him the whole way.
Whenever I'm on a hospital bed, he'll jump up and lay by my legs. Like, help me get settled, and when I'm older, he'll go to school with me when I'm fully trained.
Josh is just 11 years old, and his body is still very small, so he's still in training to handle Mason on his own. Josh says that by the time he reaches middle school, he'll probably be ready to bring Mason to school with him.
It's nice to have him to help me call me.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Fairmont.
Professional service dogs like Mason undergo intensive training that can take years. But some groups help train people to teach their own pets to become therapy animals. For this next story, we head to Cumberland County, Pennsylvania. Reporter Carrie Burkett explores how a program called Dog Tags teaches veterans with PTSD how to train their own dogs to become therapy dogs.
In a large warehouse-like facility in Mechanicsburg, a group of U.S. veterans gather and bring along their dogs for a weekly training session. The canines are learning how to help their masters cope with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Dealing with PTSD, you're always hypervigilant, you're always on alert, you feel like you have to constantly be aware of your surroundings.
Veteran Brad Schroeder served in the Marine Corps and completed a tour in Iraq in 2003. He's training his dog, Cody.
Before I got Cody, I was unable to leave the house. I was really afraid of being out in public. And now that I got Cody, I'm able to go out, and he takes a little bit of that stress away from me and is allowed to kind of watch my back just like somebody out in country with me, serving in Iraq would do. At nighttime, sometimes I experience night terrors or nightmares. He sleeps in bed with me, so he knows when I'm having trouble, and he'll lick my face and wake me up. If I'm having a serious one, he can actually go and turn a light on for me. There's a task that he can go and turn a light on.
The program is called DOG, T-A-G-S, which stands for Train, Assist, Guide, Serve. The veterans also meet in a support group to talk about how the week has been for them.
Yeah, most people don't know about combat PTSD. People in this country are just being educated about it, and they're going to get a huge education in the next 5 years, because usually it takes five.
Doug Morgan served 24 years of active duty in the Pennsylvania Army National Guard. He's the kind of guy who is instantly likable. People seem instinctively to trust him.
I was actually the mayor of my town in Marysville, and I was actually elected into office.
But after a combat experience in 2000, Doug encountered a darker side of himself.
When I came back from deployment in Bosnia, I was just totally a different person. I had anger issues, I had depression, I isolated.
Doug spent nearly 3 years hospitalized, being treated for combat PTSD. He found that working with service dogs was a great help for him in dealing with his issues. His wife Kim is a dog trainer. She's been training dogs for 10 years. Together, they became leaders in founding the Dog Tags program.
The mission is to train the veteran service dogs to help them mitigate the issues that they have with post-traumatic stress disorder. If they have acute social phobias, sometimes just walking straight up to them, they need you to stay out of their space. And the dog can be trained to just move in front of them in position to offer a couple feet barrier from people.
You don't have, you know, your M4. You don't have, yeah. You know, your battle gear. You don't. Your dog is all your stuff right now. And that's a huge...
Veteran Thomas Ward II was with the 1st Cavalry Division in Vietnam in 1967 with the Hunter Killer Squadron.
We were a reconnaissance unit in Vietnam. Flew around helicopters a lot and that sort of thing. When I first got in the program, I literally couldn't even talk. I wouldn't even be able to talk to you today. But this program here with all the dogs and being around the group of people all the time, I'm able to talk now more about my military career. My military career, sometimes, if I told it to people, some people, they would literally cry. It was that bad. And this dog program has extremely helped me out. And I get out in public now more. I used to be really reclusive.
One of the newer veterans to the program, Scott, has not had a good week. His dog, Molly, is curled at his feet as he shares.
That night, I got home. I was waiting on these to come in my driveway. So that's how bad it was.
Scott, you know, he had previously had, you know, a bad experience, you know, when he went out on an outing on his own. And so it was important for us to, you know, get them back out there and experience it with some seasoned veterans who've been there and done that.
Next week, we'll plan an outing.
An outing is planned to take the dogs into stores so the trainers can observe and evaluate their behavior in a public space. The veterans and their dogs, including Scott and his dog Molly, meet up with the trainers the following week on a grassy area at the edge of a Walmart parking lot.
Everybody peed and pooped?
All right. We're going to go in and spend...
John Cirillo is one of the dog trainers.
The purpose of the day is to get the dogs out in a congested situation to make sure that they behave properly and that they stay attentive to their owners.
All right. We're working on approaching the building, so...
The dog team split up and moved through the stores. The dogs seemed calm and well-behaved, even in some of the most distracting situations.
This is the ultimate test, I guess, yes, with is. The dog food aisle.
It is. This is really tough. When they got to come to the dog treat aisle and not help themselves.
The dogs do attract a lot of attention in the stores. Scott and Molly are greeted by strangers as they move through the aisles.
I've never seen a golden retriever that color. She is darling. She is darling.
Molly seems to take it in stride. But as I move in closer, something happens. Molly starts to exhibit signs of distress. The trainer warns me away.
Hey, find another dog team.
It's me, with my threatening microphone and recorder, which is causing Molly's distress. Afterwards, I speak once again with trainer John Cirillo.
So what do you think? How did the dogs do today?
Most, if not all, of the dogs exceeded our expectation. The dogs behaved better than I think most of us anticipated they would, so it's great all the way around.
I also seek out Scott to apologize for intruding on his excursion with Molly. Scott doesn't want me to record our conversation. In fact, he doesn't want the microphone around him. He has issues with microphones, he tells me, and with news people in general. He's quick to assure me that it's nothing personal. It just brings back some bad memories for him. I realize that Molly's reaction in the store was because she was sensing Scott's discomfort at my presence. For a veteran with PTSD, even a simple thing like a microphone can be a trigger for those bad memories. But Scott asks me to make sure that the message gets out about the value of this program for veterans and the value of bonding with the dogs. Maybe veteran Brad Schroeder expressed it best.
Cody has come along and been the best medicine I've ever had. There's a lot of guys like that don't leave their house or they're seriously depressed. I think it's 8 veterans a day kill themselves in America, so it's just a horrible thing. And to have a dog that can take away some of that burden on you, that can help you, it's just amazing. And it's not a chemical you're putting in your body. It's not, you know, it's not a drug. It's an actual tool that you can use to live a better life.
The staff for the Dog Tags program is all volunteer and unpaid. There's a link to their website at WITF.org in the Arts and Life section. For the WITF Arts and Culture Desk, I'm Carrie Burkett.
We end the show with a dog story from Randolph County, West Virginia. Back in February, a 67-year-old man named Curly Ray said he thought he had lost his little Pomeranian during a snowstorm. This was especially troubling to Ray because he had actually lost another dog who was hit by a car just 3 days earlier. So when another one of his dogs went missing, and with the weather dropping to single-digit temperatures, Ray said he just about gave up hope of finding his dog named Little Dog.
The little dog was gone, and I thought she was going to be gone, too, and I was praying. I asked God, I said, oh, please, please don't let another dog be gone. I just can't stand it.
That night, Curly Ray was so anxious he couldn't sleep. But the next morning, his other dogs led him to a place in the snow.
And I went over and looked in the, there was a little hole there, and there was a digging trying to get in and whatever was in there out. And I looked and I saw my little Pomeranian's nose. She's pretty old. She's about 12 years old. So I went to my truck and got a hatchet out of the back of the truck. I began to chop, and I chopped, and so I got enough chopped away that I could put my hand back in the hole, and put my hand on her head. I saw she was alive. I was a happy camper. I began to dance, and thank God because she was alive. Tears rolling out of my eyes. So I kept on chopping until I got her out. Back inside the snow cave where she was at, her body had made a large cavity where she could turn around. Her body heat had melted the snow. Only thing I could see wrong with her nose was a little bit frostbit. So I took her in the house, took off running for the bedroom, laid down in her dog bed that was underneath of my bed. So after a while, I called for her, and she came back out, and I said, give her some treats. And I gave her all the treats she could eat that day. And those Pomeraniums, I got 2 of them. It wouldn't have been for them digging on her and getting her out of that ice cave. She would have been dead today. So I'm thanking God for that, and I got my little dog back.
Curly Ray then called his veterinarian, who told him to check for little dog's vital signs. Although she spent the entire night down in that little snow cave, she's doing just fine. We talked to Ray by phone from his 150-acre farm on Kelly Mountain. He said his little dog was at his feet, watching him with affection during the interview.
You know, dogs are one of the best things that God has ever made to give to man. They're the best friend you can ever have. I think people should be really good to dogs because they don't live very long anyway, and cats the same way. Those animals, you can absolutely feel the love coming off of a dog.
That's it for this week. Hey, we got some great pictures on Twitter this week. So a special thanks to everyone that sent us an image of your favorite Appalachian hound dog. You can see the photo album on our website, wvpublic.org. And we'd love to see more. So if you haven't already, tweet a photo of your dog to @inAppalachia, #dogsinAppalachia. Till next time, stay warm, stay cozy. And to all you dogs out there, we hope you find a really nice squirrel or rabbit to chase out there in the woods inside Appalachia.
cell. I know you run down sucking and wore out you. And let me be your soldier dog. Let me be your soldier dog, or I won't be your man at all. And let me be your soldier dog. Setting on a log, finger on the trigger and eye on the hog. Honey, let me be your solid dog. Let me be your solid dog, or I won't be your man at all. Honey, let me be your solid dog. Go, the shot fell over in Mexico. And let me be your solid dog. Let me be your solid dog, or I won't be your man at all. And let me be your solid dog.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Allegheny Front, NPR, Traveling 219, and WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Music in today's show was provided by Andy Agnew, Flat and Scruggs. Our What's in a Name theme song is Johnson Ridge Special by Martika and William, and the Glenville State Bluegrass Band. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.